I appreciate you being here and spending some time with us in God's Word. Three times, apparently, you're going to make me work. So, okay, that's fine. I'll have more to say about that shortly. But, you know, the reading that we just had from Luke 23, you may not need to turn over there, but if you want to, just to have that in the back of your mind. And we were talking last night about one of the more, at least to me, one of the more impressive things about the Bible, and that is that there are no incidental details that we are given. And if it seems like they are, it's usually because we haven't figured out what they mean yet. And especially you see this in some of these Old Testament stories that we go to, and we look at certain odd things that just kind of get dropped into a story in the middle of nowhere, and we ask, well, why is that even there? And as we start studying, we start to see patterns and examples and teachings emerge that remind us why these small details here that seem to be irrelevant are there for us. And in Luke 23, I think we see one of those. This is especially true, you know, in the Gospels. In John 20, when John is talking about why he wrote what he wrote, he says in verse 30 that Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. And there's a principle there. Obviously, John is one of my favorite books because of this, because it is so deliberate and so intentional in the way that it is written. But it's true of all of the Gospels, that there is a limited amount of space that we have to talk about these important details. And I think you see in all the Gospels that there is a reason why certain things are put in there. And we see one of these, I think, at the end of the passage that we just read. Because if you remember the story, you know, we've all read Luke 23 and the equivalent accounts in the other Gospels over and over again. We see this is the third time that Jesus has been tried that night. He has now finally been turned over to the mob, and he's going to be sent out to be crucified. And as we see, if you've ever watched Ben-Hur or some other story, or if you read the traditions, you probably know that at some point, even though the Bible doesn't say it, Jesus most likely stumbled under the load at some point. We even sing about that. And we don't know if that actually happened, but it's very likely that it did. But for whatever reason, it's at this point that the Romans see this man Simon, and they compel him to carry the cross for Jesus. It says in verse 26, as they led him away, they seized one Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, and laid on him the cross to carry it behind Jesus. And it's an odd detail because we think, well, this is the only thing that the Bible ever says about this. Why is it there? It just seems like maybe this is just color to help us appreciate how Jesus was struggling during this time. And there may be some truth to that. But what makes it more striking to me, at least, is that all three of the synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all of them include this detail. And not only do they include this detail, but they include the man's name. They are very specific about this. Now, one of the rules of thumb, at least in my view, of reading the Gospels is that when you see something that is included specifically in all three Gospels, put a mark on it because it's important. It's there for a reason, because all three of these writers said that there is something that we need to make sure to point out about this story. And yet we don't know really a lot about Simon. We're not told specifically about him, which leads us to believe that maybe Simon isn't necessarily the point of this story. Now, we can see some value, can't we, in the idea that if I am writing in the first century and I'm talking about these events and I'm trying to convince you, the reader, that Jesus died on the cross and raised from the dead, that there's going to be skepticism, and I'm going to want to try to find a way to verify it. And a great way to do that is to point to one man and say, look, if you want to know about these details, here's a man named Simon. And here's what he did. Here was his involvement. And if you want to talk to somebody who had a great witness to that day that was able to see and definitively tell you, look, this happened because I was there. I carried the cross. I followed Jesus to the cross. And we don't know. It may very well be that Simon stayed and watched. I suspect that after having done this, Simon most likely would have probably at least stayed around to see what was going on and why this man was being crucified. So we can see the value, I think, in him from the standpoint of being a named eyewitness of the death of Christ. But I think there may be some more going on here in terms of what's going on. And I think it helps to think about Simon from his own viewpoint and from what was going on around him in his own mind and his own thoughts. And we don't know, as I said, very much about him. We do know Mark 15, the parallel account, tells us that he was a passerby coming in from the country. And that could mean a couple of different things. It could mean possibly that he was a resident of Jerusalem that owned farmland and that had been out working. And now in the afternoon, as the Sabbath was coming closer, he might have been coming in from the country after having worked, and he gets caught up in all this. That's a possibility. What's more likely, though, and what most seem to think, is that this man is named as Simon of Cyrene, which Cyrene would have been an area where we would now call Libya. So he was an African Jew. We know he was a Jew because he was in Jerusalem and he was coming in. It's a pretty strong indication that he was a Jew that lived in Africa that was probably coming in for the Feast of the Passover that was being prepared during that time. And when we think about what must have been going through his mind in the setting of all of this, again, nothing happens by accident. Jesus is being led to the cross on the day when the lamb is going to be slaughtered, the blood is going to be painted on the doorposts, and the day when God passed over Israel and spared them and brought them out of Egypt is going to be commemorated. And it's no doubt, if you think about Simon and what he's been going through, he's made this long trip from Libya. He's come up, he's gotten on the ship, he's landed on the coast of the Mediterranean, he's walking up, coming to Jerusalem. He's probably not alone. He's probably with a group of however many Jews that were probably caravaning together, going up to Jerusalem. They were singing songs, as they often did, the songs of ascent, if you look in the book of Psalms, that were typically sung as the pilgrims came up the road towards Jerusalem. They would have seen the holy city, and they would have been thinking about the significance of the things that they're about to do and about to observe. The idea of the lamb that was slaughtered, the blood that was shed, the freedom that they now have, and thinking about that significance. And if you figure, Simon most likely was thinking about all the things that he needed to do in the next few minutes, because Sabbath is coming, and of course, once the sun goes down, he can't do any work. So he's got a lot to do. He's got to, first of all, get to the temple and offer his atonement sacrifice so that he can be cleansed and so he can participate in all these things. Second of all, he's got to get the Passover lamb, he or at least somebody in his party. They've got to prepare it. They've got to get everything ready for the feast, assuming they don't already have a place. He's got a lot of work to do and not a lot of time. And he doesn't have time to get distracted by some secular activity that's going on around about him. And so when he gets up into this hill, you can imagine what he sees as he gets this progression, this procession coming out of the city. And maybe he's already in the city. And he's walking down the road, and he sees this line of people coming, and he sees three men at the head of them, each one carrying a cross. And he knows what that means because he's a part of the Roman Empire. This would not have necessarily been an uncommon thing, but he knows very clearly, as the writer Plutarch, who's a Greek biography, once said, that every criminal condemned to death bears his cross on his back. He knows what it means to see this man walking along, bearing a cross. He might have thought, well, I wonder what these people did to deserve this, but it must have been bad, because crucifixion was something that was reserved for the worst. And we already read in Luke 23 that the man that was supposed to be bearing this cross was Barabbas. He was an insurrectionist. He was a murderer. He was a thief. He was all of these things. And it might very well be that that's exactly what Simon thought this man was. Whatever he did, he must have done something pretty bad to deserve this. And right about now you're thinking, I don't have time for this. I got to get around. So I got to figure out a way to get through all this mess and go do the things that I need to do. And all of a sudden, one of the Romans looks at him and says, "You come here." And he grabs him by the arm and says, "All right, you need to carry this cross." Whether it was because Jesus had fallen under the load, as we often sing, whether it was because they were just going too slow and the Romans wanted to pick up the pace a little bit. Maybe because he just wanted to do it. Romans is Jesus, when he talks about the idea in the Sermon on the Mount, if anyone compels you to go a mile with him, go with him twain. The Roman soldier had the right at any given time to point out anybody in the crowd and say, "You carry my stuff, let's go." And they would have had to have done it. And he probably assumed, well, this is what's going on now, and I'm just going to have to deal with it. And so all of a sudden now, you've had all these thoughts of what you're going to do today, and you find all those things thrown out the window, because you are now separated from your party. You're carrying this blood-smeared beam of wood behind a man who you don't know, but clearly must not be a very good person. You're surrounded by a mass of people, and some of them are crying, and some of them are jeering, and you have no idea what's going on. except that this day is clearly not going the way that you intended it to go. And as you walk behind him, you can imagine, because Luke makes this point that he's walking and carrying this cross behind Jesus. And you can imagine the view that he had. And the thing that must have stood out more as he walks along is what this man has gone through and how he has suffered during this time. He sees the ripped back. He sees the garments caked with blood. He sees this man who's clearly been scourged and suffering and laboring and clearly is not long for this world because he's been beaten nearly to death. And it must have been really remarkable to him because at some point Luke tells us during this journey that Jesus stops and turns around and looks at the crowd. And you have to wonder, Simon must be saying, well, he's going to let him have it now. All these people that have been jeering him, and he must have something to say. This is the criminal finally giving it back. And it must have been remarkable that he looks at the women that are weeping for him, and he says, daughters, do not weep for me, but weep for this city. He says in Luke 23, verse 30, that they will begin to say to the mountains, fall on us and to the hills, cover us. There's something that's going to be happening to you that's even worse than anything you're watching right now. And assuming that Simon was, as the Ethiopian eunuch was over in Acts chapter 8, a student of the scriptures, he might have thought back to Hosea where this passage is quoted from and thought about all the prophets that had come before and had spoken about Jerusalem and said something very, very similar to this and how Jerusalem had treated all of them. They're all dead because they'd all been put to death by a group of people that didn't want to hear the message that God had sent to them. And maybe at some point, you're starting to think, I wonder what I'm really seeing here. Something's not adding up here. Am I seeing another example of Jerusalem killing one of its prophets? And so finally, they get to the top. And you can imagine, again, I find it hard to believe that he just dropped the wood and said, okay, I'm out of here. You know, curiosity would have compelled him to stay around at least long enough to find out what's going on. And at least as he sees this man nailed to the cross and he sees him raised up and he sees the Romans writing this sign and putting it up, now he at least has a name to attach to this man. He sees the name that says, this is Jesus, King of the Jews. And that would have raised all kinds of questions, wouldn't it? This is a man that apparently the Romans believed to be the Jewish king, and he is being nailed to a cross. What was going through his mind? And why is this story here? Well, again, I think we can make some assumptions about that. And there's one thing. Again, as we said, we don't know very much about Simon, but we do know one other thing, is that Mark tells us that Simon was the father of Alexander and Rufus. Well, what does that mean? Well, as we talked about, everything in the gospel has meaning. There's no reason to give the name of the sons of this man, this random guy, if those names wouldn't have meant something to the people who read this letter. Is that a reasonable assumption? So maybe we think that, okay, the people that are reading this must have known, or these people, Alexander and Rufus, must have been, had some sort of meaning to these people. Well, we connect another dot over in Romans chapter 16, verse 13, when Paul is writing to the church at Rome, and he makes mention of a disciple named Rufus. And we wonder to ourselves, well, I wonder if that's the same person. I don't know how common the name Rufus was during that time. But most people believe that it's very likely that the reason that Mark writes this and gives us these details is that Alexander and Rufus would have been two men that were known to the disciples of that day because they were Christians, because they were disciples of Christ. And now we start thinking, this must have had a real impact on this man. And how could it not? Simon, who witnesses these things and sees all the conflicting ideas surrounding it and seeing Jesus' attitude and maybe even staying around long enough to hear Jesus say, Father, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing. Seeing his attitude and being nailed to the cross, just like everybody else that was there and seeing that there's something remarkable about what's going on. Maybe that changed something. Maybe that made him stop and think about what he had mentioned, what he had just witnessed. And maybe, just maybe, when Peter stands up in Acts 2, 40 days later, and says, this Jesus whom you crucified, God has made both Lord and Christ. Maybe he thinks to himself, you know, I carried that cross. I was accomplice to this. I brought this just man to his death. What must that have meant to him? What must that have done to change his life? So much so that Maybe he was one of the 3,000 that obeyed the gospel in Acts chapter 2. You know, we don't know any of the answers to those. I'd like to think that's what happened. I think there's strong reason to believe that that is the case. But I think that there's even more going on here just in the story of Simon. I don't think Simon is really necessarily the point of this, because if he were, we would probably know a lot more about him. I would suggest to you that Simon may be there to represent something even more important to us, because just like Simon's story is mentioned in all three Gospels, Jesus makes another statement earlier in his life that is also in all three Gospels. And if you look over at Matthew chapter 16, we'll look at one example of those, because if you remember back in Matthew 16, Jesus has just received the great confession from Peter, who has said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And at that point, it says that Jesus begins to describe to his disciples how he will go to Jerusalem and how he will suffer all these things and be killed, and on the third day he will be raised up. And if you remember, in verse 22, it says that Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from me, Lord, this shall never happen to you." But he turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a hindrance for me, because you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." And Jesus told his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul?" You know, that phrase that Jesus uses here has become almost a cliche. How many times have we heard something? We all have our crosses to bear. You know, it actually bothers me a little bit. I remember reading something on Facebook the other day, a while back, I guess, and it was, you know, the whole mask debate. And I don't know, I'm not really interested on any level in getting into that discussion whatsoever, but I will say that we want to acknowledge that there was a lot of arguments about that, especially when all these things first started. And one man, I know he meant well, said, "You know, I'm going to wear my mask, even if I don't think I need to, because you know what, we all have our crosses to bear." And I thought to myself, you know, I love your attitude, but you're missing something here. Because if all that bearing my cross means to me is a minor inconvenience one day out of the week, then we've missed this point of the story. Because when Jesus tells these people, "Take up your cross and follow me," they knew what he meant, and it wasn't about being inconvenienced. It's the idea that you see this image of a man carrying a cross, and you know what's going to happen to him. He's going to his death, and you need to be prepared as a disciple of Christ. If you want to follow him, you need to be ready to do that too. And specifically looking at Peter and the other disciples, likely saying, "And you will. This is going to be your end. You have a problem with Jesus dying on the cross? Well, you're going to do the same thing." Peter, of course, we know historically from common tradition, was crucified also. Crucified upside down, apparently, because he did not see himself as being worthy of being sacrificed in the same way that his Lord was sacrificed. And we don't know if that's true, but it seems likely that that's probably what happened. And it seems, knowing Peter, that that's exactly the kind of thing that he would have said. He's talking about a real sacrifice in this context. It's not just talking about a singular incident. Luke gives us an additional detail on this. In Luke 9:23, he says, "Take up his cross daily and follow me." It's not something you do at any given moment. It's something that you are continually doing with a continual expectation of what this is going to cost and what this is going to lead to. And he says in verse 26, "For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father and of the holy angels." You notice Luke, back in chapter 23, gives us one more detail in this story. He says that he laid him on him the cross to carry it behind Jesus. You wonder, well, why did Luke make a point of saying that? Well, I don't think it's just to show us that Simon had a good view of Jesus' wounds as he walked up the cross. Luke's book, if you study the book of Luke, it's a fascinating study to look at the synoptic gospels and look at what each man focuses on and what each man is trying to accomplish with his teaching. And it gives you a lot of insight into why something is here and not there, and why Luke describes it differently than how Matthew describes it, and all these other different things. But Luke's focus primarily, or at least one of them, is the concept of discipleship. And his image here is that Simon took up his cross and followed Jesus. And that is the model. As all Christians, as disciples of Christ, you are to be following Jesus. And you follow him under the worst of circumstances, even when you're being derided, even when canceling your plans, even when it's inconvenient, even when it does things to you that causes people to lump you in with who they consider to be the most horrible people in the world. Even when it causes you to be jeered and ridiculed. You know, Simon, as we said, his contact with the cross that day changed his plans for that day completely. He everything that I had planned for that day goes by the wayside now because everything has been put away. You know, and you can imagine people and how they would have looked at him even after this is all over. Imagine that same Simon walking up. Is he the same Simon walking up that hill now? No, because now we've got a Simon that is no doubt smeared with blood. He is sweaty. He's disgusting. He's clearly been physically marred by this situation. And anyone looking at him would have thought, what have you done? And maybe somebody even said, aren't you the one who carried Jesus' cross? Why did you do that? Were you one of his disciples too? Isn't that what was told Peter? Well, Peter was, you know, I've seen you with Jesus. You're a Galilean. You must be with Jesus too. And of course, Peter denied it. I don't want to be a part of that. I don't have any association with the thing that has just been going on. Simon was forced to bear and be associated with the cross of Christ against his will. And when we think about what that means for us, you know, even in the South, all right, we got a lot of people, we're surrounded by people that love Jesus, that will say, will tell you in every indication that they can, I love Jesus. But more often than not, the Jesus that they love is not the Jesus that is bloody and dying and walking up to the cross and telling them that they need to do the exact same thing. The Jesus that so many people in our world love is the Jesus that stands and says, you don't have to change anything. Don't inconvenience yourself. Do whatever you want to do in your life. Don't mind me. I'm going to do all the work for you. You just stand by and watch. Don't get your hands dirty. Jesus required Simon to be stained with his blood. And Jesus was very clear, as we said, that following him would come at a cost. As he tells the disciples in John 15, verse 18, he says, if the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love you as its own, but because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. We're not going to get around that. There is no version of discipleship that allows me to be popular with the world. There is no way that I can follow Jesus, taking up and carrying my cross, that the world is not going to look at me and say, I don't want to be a part of that. I'm not going to make that decision. That person is disgusting to me. He's revolting to me. He is corrupted by the things that he is following. I don't have anything to do with that. If we don't have that, at least in some degree in our lives, if we're living in a way that the world looks at us and doesn't see anything repugnant about the way that we live, I'm not talking about from a moral standpoint. I'm talking from the standpoint of not wanting to live the way the world has lived, rejecting the things that the world has called us to embrace, living in a way that we say, that's not tolerant. That's not acceptable in our culture, in our society. We can't have any part of that. Being a disciple of Christ means wearing like a badge so that all can see. And there's another great irony in this story. And of course, the Bible, I'm a big fan of irony, as Laura will tell you. And what we see often is that the Bible uses irony with great effect. And we see here, when we think about, again, the context of this story and what's going on, Simon is going along with Jesus, and he's carrying this cross, and he's left, as we said, sweaty and bloody. And what does that mean to him in the context of what he's been doing? You know, what was he about to do? I'm about to go to the temple and make a sacrifice so I can take the Passover. Not today, you're not, because you are now unclean. You can't go to the temple like this. You are now separated. You've got to wait and remain unclean until the end of the day. Your day's done. There's an irony there that the thing that has defiled Simon under the law, that has separated him, that has barred him from coming into the presence of God, is the thing that ultimately will make him clean. Is that an accident? I don't think it is. When Jesus rose and ascended and the apostles took the gospel out to the world, beginning with the Jewish nation, what was the overwhelming reaction to that message? We don't have anything to do with it. It's a curse. It's unthinkable what you're saying. The Son of God, the Messiah that has been promised, and you're telling me that he hung on a tree and was killed on Calvary? I don't believe that. I don't accept it at all. You know, we've been studying the book of Zechariah. In Zechariah chapter 12, if you remember this prophecy, there's a little interesting detail in it that you see. Over in Zechariah chapter 10, it says, "And I will pour out on the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of grace and pleas for mercy, so that when they look on me, on him whom they have pierced, they shall mourn for him." Now, I think we understand pretty clearly what's being talked about here, but notice the pronoun shift there. He says, "When they look on me," who's talking here? God is talking. He says, "On me, on him whom they have pierced." And it's interesting that when you study that verse, what you find is that the Jewish scribes of that day had such an issue with this that ultimately they changed it. They took out the "me" and just made it "him," because there's no way that a God that I worship, that a mighty king, is going to be subject to what he's talking about right here. God will not be pierced. That is not going to happen. The idea of God being brought down and made in the image of man and going to a cross, which according to what we see in the scriptures, is a curse. Curses everyone who hangs on a tree. It's just not something that the Hebrew world was willing to accept. And yet it is this curse, is this defilement through which we have our salvation. Colossians 2, Paul writes about this idea of being circumcised with a circumcision made without hands. And in verse 12, he says, "Having been buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised with him through faith in the powerful working of God, who raised him from the dead, and you who were dead in your trespasses and in the uncircumcision of your flesh, God made alive together with him, having forgiven us all our trespasses, by canceling the record of debt that stood against us with its legal demands. This he set aside, nailing it to the cross. He disarmed the rulers and the authorities and put them to an open shame by triumphing over them." And we think about Simon, who would seemingly have been a pious worshiper of God, who was coming to worship God, and now all of a sudden he is forced to be defiled by the blood of this man. And you wonder, did it ever cross his mind that maybe I wasn't as pious as I thought? That maybe this image that I'm seeing now is who I really am before God. Smeared with blood, on my way to the cross, to the scene where I will be put to death, because that is what I deserve for the sin that I've committed in my life. That's the message of the cross, isn't it? The cross makes us see the sin in our lives and all of its ugliness and everything that we deserve, and knowing that God could not come up with a more graphic and gruesome detail of showing us that this is the cost of sin. And you get to witness it. And you get to remind yourself that as Jesus is carrying his cross, I'm carrying it too, because that's the debt that I owe. And Jesus is going to pay it for me. So as we come to the cross today, what do we see? When we see it in the way that Simon would have experienced it, I think there's some things that we can see, and I'm going to go through it pretty quickly because I know I'm running short of time, and I'm going to do my best to respect that. What do we see? We see, as we've talked about, the consequences of sin. The sin and its ugliness and what it means to us. And what it means to be relieved of that burden. As we see in Ephesians chapter 2, it talks about that even when we were dead in our trespasses, we were condemned to die. He says he has made us alive together with Christ. That's our problem. That's the thing that we face. And as John 8:24, Jesus says that without Christ, he says, if you do not believe that I am he, you will die in your sins. This is your fate. Second of all, we see in Jesus the faithfulness of a servant who is willing to take up his cross, the cross that should have been mine, and go to the cross. In 2 Timothy 2:13, it says that if we are faithless, he remains faithful. And of course, the world often misuses that to say, well, I can do whatever I want to do, and Jesus is still going to save me. But the point that he's making is that Jesus is willing to do all that God called him to do, even when we don't deserve it, even when we have acted in a way that was faithless, we have broken faith with God, we have violated his law, we are worthy of death, and yet Jesus did not look at that and say, well, if they're not going to try, I'm not going to try either. Jesus did exactly what he was called to do. As Hebrews 12:2 says, "He for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God." We see, thirdly, the idea of the certainty of our triumph. Because as horrible as this scene is, and as marred by blood and pain and suffering as it is, and as certain as the death must have seemed, there was no going back at this point. Jesus on the way to the cross, everybody knew how that was going to end. And the Jews even mocked him. They said, if you're the Christ, come down from the cross now and we'll believe you. Because they knew it wasn't going to happen. Jesus wasn't going anywhere. But we know that as sure as that death was, the glorification of God, the fulfillment of his will, was even more certain. And we have an assurance in that, because we see that if Christ went to the cross, the most horrible death that can imagine, and yet Jesus was raised up by the power of God anyway, we know that there's nothing that this world can do for me that is not going to lead to my triumph through the grace of God. In 2 Corinthians 4, it says that knowing that he who raised the Lord Jesus will raise us also with Jesus and bring us with you into his presence. The fact that Jesus was raised is what gives us courage to do whatever we can do today, whatever we need to do today, knowing that there's nothing the world can do to us that will separate us from the love of God. We see finally, I think, a unity of purpose. How can we think about this a lot, and I know my time's getting away. I'll try not to get too brief, but this is the thing that struck me probably as much as anything in this as I was thinking about this, because we live in a world that is divided and maybe beyond repair in our culture. And the reason that it is divided is because all of us have different ideas on what is important in life, what we want to spend our time on, how we want our place to be, our country to be governed, all the things of this world that matter to us and are so important that we can't allow anything to distract us. And all of a sudden we find ourselves at odds with each other because we can't ever reconcile those different viewpoints of life. But you know what happens when we follow Jesus? The same thing that happens with Simon as he's following, and no doubt his entire field of vision, what was he looking at the entire time? He was looking at Jesus. He was looking at his suffering. He was looking at the price that was being paid. Did Simon understand that at that time? No, I'm sure he didn't. But I suspect he understood it later. And the idea that when we fix our mind and we fix our hearts on Jesus, everything else kind of goes away, doesn't it? All of a sudden, I've got one aim, and that is to stay behind my Savior in the work that he is doing. And Ephesians 2 talks about the idea in verse 14 that he is our peace, who has made us both one and has broken down the flesh, the dividing wall of hostility, by abolishing the law of commandments expressed in ordinances, that he might create in himself one new man in place of the two, so making peace, and might reconcile us both to God in one body through the cross. Jew and Gentile, killing the hostility. Why? Because my thing doesn't matter anymore. Your thing doesn't matter anymore. My priorities, your priorities, my life has changed to the point where the only thing that matters to me now as a disciple is serving God. And if you're doing that and I'm doing that and we're all following the same master, what happens to our individual preferences, our individual agendas, our individual goals for our life? They go away. And we are united in a way that is completely and utterly impossible in any other aspect of our life. That's why it's so important for us to be one. Because when we are united as different people from different cultures, different races, different backgrounds, different economic status, all of those things, and the world says we need to segment you into these different groups and we want to look at you as competing interests in this world, and one has to win and one has to lose, and the world is just determined to divide us. And we tell them, none of those things matter because I'm too busy following Jesus. And when I do that, these other things go away. And we can be united, and we can be one. And let's be honest, when we're not united, when we have division in the Lord's church, when we have anger and bitterness and rivalries among our disciples, it is always for one reason, and one reason is alone, is because we have lost sight of who we're following. That's the only reason. So did Simon understand any of this? Probably not. But I suspect he did. And we need to understand those things. And it is the answer in a lot of ways to any of our questions that we have in terms of how can I be a disciple of Christ. Follow Christ. It's that simple. It's also that hard. There's nothing easy about that assignment. But there's nothing complicated about it either. Only when we make it that way, isn't it? Hebrews 12, verse 1 through 2, is the Hebrew writer has summed up the hall of fame, if you want to call it that, in chapter 11. And he says, seeing all this, what does he say? Let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. That's our hope. If we keep our eyes on Jesus, we can do what Simon did. We can carry a cross, and yet we don't have to die. We can live, because we live in Christ. Blessed is yours this morning. Hopefully it's been useful and encouraging as we think about our own lives and our own walks with God, and we examine ourselves every day as we ought to do. Am I doing this? Does my life feel like I am following Jesus in whatever circumstances I am called to follow him? Or do I find myself picking it up and laying it down and moving on to do other things because I've got other things that I need to worry about today? Which is the most important thing in my life? Whatever your need may be this morning, if you haven't been obeyed the gospel of Christ, you have not put him on yet, you haven't started that walk, you haven't determined to give your life over to Christ, we can make that right this morning. We have a baptistry, I'm assuming, that's filled with water or can be filled shortly, if that's your need. If you need to repent of any sin in your life that's separating you from God in a public way and you want to make that right, whatever it may be, if you just need prayers for encouragement, I invite you to come now as we'll end our invitation song. Let's stand.